You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, April 13th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everyone.
Jay is off this week. He's out gallivanting with his family or something.
Oh, how dare he.
You know. I know.
How dare he miss a week. Oops. It's good to be back, everyone.
I haven't missed a week in 18 years.
Wow.
Is that right?
That's right.
That's
I
true.
Have.
We all have, yeah. Except Steve.
But in fairness, that's because we work around my schedule.
You're right.
Well, that makes sense.
That's true. Yeah.
I mean, you know
need
how to
miss.
Turn
the, we just, yeah, we find
you know how to push
time.
The buttons and turn
yeah, I know.
Thing
I,
on
have,
and...
I have to make it happen. Yeah.
I just sit here and look pretty.
So I almost missed tonight. Because
I know. We were scrambling.
You guys, it's biblical out there. Okay. And I don't think I realized it. Like, since Monday, it's been raining nonstop in South Florida. And yesterday, so Monday was pretty, like, whatever. Okay, it's raining. It always rains. Tuesday, I work from home, so I didn't really realize it. Wednesday, I go in, and I was like, there's a lot of flooding out there. And then it was like, two tornado warnings while we were at work, people canceling, not showing up to the clinic. I walked home, and the flooding was up to my knees.
What?
Yeah. And then I just saw online, I just shared it actually on Instagram, and you can see some, like, great flooding videos that I posted on my Instagram. Florida's previous rainfall record for the entire month of April, 1979, they got 19 inches in the whole month of April.
Ooh,
yesterday, we got 25 inches in 7 hours.
What?
Yep.
Nothing compares. Nothing compares to that.
What?
Wow.
And it's still raining outside, you guys. So I lost power earlier, which is why I almost wasn't able to come. But the power was restored. My internet's back up. I am here.
Let's hope it holds.
Yeah. Well, it actually, it's the rain right now is just a steady flow. Earlier, it looked like I took video from inside my patio sliding doors, and it looked like I was in one of those drive-through car washes.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's, yeah, it was that bad.
With the hula skirts.
Sheets of rain, mm-hmm. of water pouring down.
Bananas.
Hula skirt.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Crocs came in handy.
Wow.
Had to put them in sport mode.
I wonder if this was one of those atmospheric rivers that I've heard about, read about. And I know they happen in California. I just never heard of them happening in Florida. I don't know if Florida is really situated for them.
I think it's just rain. Like, it's like hurricane levels of rainfall without a hurricane. Or at least that's everything I've been reading.
How windy has it been?
Today was very windy.
Mm.
Yesterday, the wind picked up a little bit. It wasn't so bad earlier in the week. But today, it was raining sideways. Faux show.
Yeah.
And is all the flooding due to the rain itself, or is there any surging of the ocean waters?
It, as far inland as I am, there's no way that this could be ocean water.
It's
Davie.
Not a low pressure, because if it were, then by definition, wouldn't that be a hurricane or tropical storm?
Yeah, I don't think it is. It doesn't have any of the kind of classic features.
The steady rain. Wind. I think the steadiness of the wind defines whether
the shape,
it's a tropical
right?
storm
the wind,
or
right?
hurricane.
The speed,
but aren't they also like a cycloney shape?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, and I don't think it looks.
Right.
The Doppler didn't look anything.
Yeah,
like
it has
that.
To have a form, a structure.
I bet you in Fort Lauderdale proper, like by the water, a lot of the flooding is storm surge stuff coming in from the ocean. But where I am in Davie, I am so far inland. It's just there's no drainage here, or I don't know. It's, the city planning is not great. There's no sewers. There's just nowhere for the water to go.
Oh my
gosh. There's a lot, don't get me wrong, where I live, luckily, it's not all concrete. I'm very close to the Everglades, and there's a lot of greenery. There's a lot of grass. There's a lot of soil. But it can only be, once it's fully saturated, it's fully saturated.
Mm-hmm.
And all of the storm, like all the dips and rivers and little pond-like areas, they're just flooding and overflowing into parking lots.
And what happens also is the wildlife goes... You know, spreads out, you know, all of a sudden alligators everywhere, snakes in places.
Yeah.
As
the water retreats. Actually, a friend of mine posted just in her neighborhood, she was filming. It was so bananas looking. It was like, I think it was her lawn. It must have backed up to a lake or something, and there's lakes everywhere. But her lawn, because you could see the grass under the water, and there were fish swimming like
sure.
at her feet. I was like, what is happening?
Oh my gosh.
And can they have storm – how effective are the storm drains? If I know you can't have a basement in a lot of locations in Florida because the water table
yeah, there's
is
no,
so
yeah.
high.
Right.
So like, there's no place down, like for the water to go.
There's, you know, in my apartment building, there are storm drains, and you know they're storm drains because they say no dumping, you know, empties to the ocean or whatever. And I don't, and where those drains are, there is not standing water. So at least maybe something about the architecture of my apartment building that works. But when you're walking down the street, you know, I grew up in Texas and every curb had those linear drainage things at the ends of them. We don't have that here.
Yeah.
So the street just floods up and over and you can't see the curbs anymore.
Right. And I know they have stormwater management, but it just must be particularly challenging.
Yeah. It's.
So have any of you guys ever had a stress echo?
Stress echo.
Like an echocardiogram?
A stress echocardiogram.
Yeah, where you're on a treadmill?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You did?
Did you have one recently?
I had one. I had one yesterday.
How'd it go?
Good. Yeah, so I had a stress test before. This is the first time I had a stress echo. So they do a baseline echo, you know, so they're looking at your heart with the ultrasound, you know, and they look at the size, ejection fraction, contractility, wall motion, all that stuff. Then you get on the treadmill, right, for like a regular stress test. So I had to get my heart rate up to 137. That was the target heart rate, which was tricky because I'm on atenolol, which is a beta blocker, which blunts my heart rate response, right? So I had to work extra hard to get my heart rate up to, I just barely made it. You know, I barely got up to 137 before the test was over.
Really?
Yeah, it was hard, you know.
Atenolol does that?
Yeah, it's a beta blocker. It can actually, in some people, atenolol is a partial agonist, so it's not as bad as some of the pure blockers, like propranolol, for example. They can actually cause exercise intolerance because it blunts your exercise response.
Oh, interesting. That sounds sad.
So that's why some people get fatigued on it. You know, they can get exercise intolerance, but which I don't have any of that with the atenolol, but it still does blunt my heart rate response. So anyway, so I had to work really, really hard to get my heart rate up and everything. And then as soon as you're done, like you have to like jump onto the stretcher, roll over, and they immediately do another echo while your heart is beating at maximum strength.
Mm-hmm. So they track your recovery.
Well, they want to see the difference between your like resting heart function and your exercise heart function.
Right, because they're like looking at it during an echo. They're looking at a lot of stuff. They're looking at the actual muscle.
Yeah. So they look at. So looking for a couple of things. When you're exercising, the heart should be beating stronger, right? So your ejection fraction, the percentage of blood that you're squeezing out of your heart should go up. The heart should get smaller when it contracts because it's contracting more.
Yeah.
It should get, I think it also gets bigger, right? So it gets bigger and smaller, like it's going through a greater range of volume changes in order to pump more blood. And they look at how all of the heart muscle walls move, to make sure that they're all moving well. Because if you have any like regional wall motion abnormality, that could indicate that either you've had, you know, some damage,
a heart attack,
or it's not getting, that part of the heart's not getting good blood flow.
Right.
So of course, they also, during any stress test, they also look at your EKG to make sure that there's no signs of ischemia on your EKG, on just the electrical activity of your heart. So anyway, mine was perfect. So it was good.
Good.
Yeah.
Good to hear.
That's important.
Yeah. You could have led with that.
What reason did you have to do it?
Because, you know, first I'm 58, you know, that's part of the reason why I have hypertension. I get palpitations occasionally and I have, you know, a little bit of blood pressure lability, like it's labile blood pressure. So they just, you know, they just did it to be on the safe side.
Interesting.
The hardest part though, so when they're doing the echo, you have to take a deep breath and hold it.
Yeah.
Right. So
when you're recovering from the exercise,
exactly. So it was not a problem at baseline at rest.
Right.
Sure.
But imagine doing like your most intense workout, and when you're like breathing as heavy as you can, now hold your breath. Like you basically can't do it. You know.
Yeah.
Because you're screaming to blow off that CO2. Like your brain is like really maximal respiratory drive.
Yeah.
So I was only able to do it for like a second at a time, but they were able to get the images that they needed. But that was the hardest part. Mm. You know, I'm like huffing and puffing away. Now hold your breath.
So hold your breath.
I had to get some really intense workups previously, and it turns out that I have something called inappropriate sinus tachycardia. But she doesn't even like that diagnosis because apparently people who usually have that, which is basically just like a fast heart rate, have palpitations too. And so like when I was wearing a Holter monitor for a whole week, you're supposed to keep a log of every time you have palpitations and push the button. I've never had a palpitation. I don't know what that feels like. Like, it just feels like your heart is going too fast.
It could be a number of things. It could feel like your heart pauses or skips a beat. It could feel like...
Okay. Like a flutter, almost?
It could feel like a flutter. It could feel like your heart beats, has an extra beat thrown in there, or it beats, like, inappropriately strong one time.
Interesting. I've had all those variations
on palpitations.
Yeah, that does sound scary. I think I told you guys all of that happened because I was wearing a fitness monitor and it kept going off and being like, abnormal heart rate.
Oh, my resting pulse is a problem with those
really
things.
High. Yeah.
It's a problem with wearing the wearables.
And that's basically, I mean, it's good that I got it checked out, but basically the outcome was your heart beats fast. Nobody knows why. The heart muscle's super healthy, even when it's stressed. Don't worry about it. Come back in 30 years.
But that is a good point, though, and... I remember learning this even in medical school, you know, that when you start to increase your surveillance of whatever, you know, biological parameters of patients, it can have unintended consequences. Like, for example, I remember when I was rotating through OB, you know, delivering babies, and it was in vogue at the time to do the intrauterine monitor. Like, you would stick a lead literally on the baby's head to record their heart rate, right?
Yeah.
And it led to an increase in C-sections because the heart rate, you know, because like when you do a contraction, the baby's heart can stop, you know, or it could drop their pressure and, you know, it could do all kinds of things. So basically everyone was freaking out at the normal stuff that was happening during delivery. And then they were panicking and leading to C-sections. So then the discussion became, maybe we should just not do it. Routinely, we'll do it on high risk births or if we have a reason to do it. But just like if we just don't look, we won't freak out at this normal stuff that's happening that looks scary. So this is the same kind of thing where it's like, if you lived your life with a heart monitor, there's probably all kinds of weird rhythms that your heart goes into every now and then that you may mildly feel it or not feel it at all. And if you just ignore it or don't know that it's there, you go about your life and it's no problem. But if everyone knows about every little thing that's happening, how many follow-up tests is that going to result in?
Sure.
How many false positives will that result in? How many unnecessary procedures or prescriptions of medications or just anxiety? People think they're going to die.
Anxiety. I utilize this principle all the time in psychotherapy. Like this concept that, yes, there is quote unquote normal, like they're norms tables. We can look at population data. It, you know, obviously we know that there are norms tables. There's normed data that comes from population level statistics. But when you look at fitness monitors or even like you were talking about kind of medical norms, those are population level. We're not comparing ourselves to ourselves. That's how we should be looking at our bodies. What is our baseline? How do we look under stress? How do we look under whatever? Like, you know, that kind of personalized medicine future we're always hoping for and thinking about. But if we're to monitor every single, you know, if we're to take our blood pressure 10 times a day, every day, sometimes you're going to be like, that's weird. It's like, but it's normal to be abnormal sometimes.
That's the point. Yep.
That's the point. Yeah. It's normal to be abnormal.
Or just that the range of normal is greater than we think. That's another principle you learn in medical school. Before you know what's abnormal, you need to learn the full range of what's normal.
Yeah.
Which is greater than you think, right? Because people don't read the textbooks. They don't necessarily follow the pristine, you know, what is quote unquote normal in the textbook is like 60, 70, 80% of like most people, but there's 20-30% of people who are just different, and it's part of the normal range, and we don't get too excited about it. But you got to learn what that range is.
Right.
It's contextualized. I think that's the other thing. Like, I always, you know, I love talking about the principle of like, you are having a normal response to an abnormal situation, as opposed to this is an abnormal response to a normal situation. Because I think so often, definitely in psychology, but I can imagine, Steve, that in medicine you see this too, where like the parameters that we're used to working with are contextualized, like at rest or under like normal conditions. And it's like, yeah, but what about, like you said, in a stress test? That's why we have to do that. What's normal heart functioning after you've just exercised? It's different than at rest. Different.
You don't do stress tests in mental health, huh? I guess life is a stress test.
Life is the stress test. So often, I mean, I see this a lot in end-of-life work and cancer and stuff when people are like, I'm crying. I've just been crying all day, every day. And I'm like, you were just diagnosed with cancer.
That's normal.
Like, it's normal to cry all day, you know? And but a lot of people, it's, we don't know because there's that pressure to, you know, somebody so much as like sheds a tear and it's like, oh, I have depression or, oh, you know, so those kinds of conversations, I think we should have. What is that normal range? It's important conversations to have.
Absolutely. So guys, let me ask you, have you ever heard of dopamine detox?
I've heard of each of those words separately.
Yeah. Is that like a tech detox?
Dopamine? Yeah, kind of.
Like it's a cell phone detox? Yeah, I mean.
Sort of.
I sometimes recommend that to some clients, but not like, I don't call it that.
But this is like more than that. It's more than just a tech detox. It's a dopamine detox. Carrie, you're going to hate this.
Yeah, you can't detox yourself from dopamine. That doesn't make any
sense. Kind of important.
It's endogenous.
You wouldn't. Well, why would you want to?
Also, yes, why would you want to? That
sounds, like something Vulcans would do.
So, yeah, I mean, this is a new trend. You know, it's I think it's very popular in Silicon Valley now, and I hate everything about it because, it, you know, it's like it's totally built on self-help pop nonsense that misunderstands how the brain works and, you know, how addiction works and how dopamine works and how detox works, you know, all kind of rolled into one.
So, to get it all so wrong on works. Every level. Yeah.
Other than that, it's great.
Yeah, it's nutraceuticals.
And, yeah. So, all right. So what's going on here? So the claim is that people are overwhelmed with dopamine because we're constantly doing things to give ourselves a dopamine hit, right? And so you spend either like a certain amount of time per day or certain amount of days per week, like one day a week or a week a year or whatever, where you avoid anything that would give you dopamine in order to sort of reset your brain so it's not addicted to dopamine, right?
Okay, that sounds impossible.
It's dumb. But let's go a little deeper and say exactly why. So first of all, it misunderstands the nature of how the brain works and how neurotransmitters work and what dopamine is, right? So dopamine is a neurotransmitter. There are many subtypes of it, and it has many effects in the brain. It is the neurotransmitter that is involved in some of the quote-unquote reward circuitry, you know, the circuitry that makes us seek out behaviors or engage in behaviors that are reinforced by the reward circuitry, right? So I think some people misinterpret that as like it's the pleasure neurotransmitter, like dopamine gives you pleasurable sensation. And that's not really what it is. It's that pleasurable sensations give you, you know, some, depending on what they are, it reinforce your reward circuitry, which is where the dopamine comes in. Right, the dopamine itself doesn't feel good. It's but you do like you know what I mean. You do something that feels
you
good.
You can't even feel dopamine.
Yeah, I mean,
like cocaine feels good.
Yeah, it's not like a drug. Yeah. It's not like a drug that activates your brain. It is just part of how the brain functions.
But the interesting thing is when you take cocaine, it acts on your dopamine system. You know what I mean? So it's like,
but if you took dopamine, it wouldn't make you feel pleasurable or wouldn't necessarily reinforce any behavior.
And ask people with Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, we give people dopamine for things like Parkinson's disease because dopamine is used in other parts of the brain, like the basal ganglia, which is involved in movement, or in some of the frontal lobe, you know, projections that are involved with thought, some higher order thought. So, for example, the reason why you actually don't give dopamine, you give pre-dopamine, right?
Then
the precursor of dopamine. And the L-dopa. And the reason we do that is because the dopamine-producing neurons in the basal ganglia are dying off. And so dopamine is the rate-limiting step now for that function. And you can give a little boost to the function of that part of the brain by giving more precursor, right? So that you're basically forcing the cells that are still there to overproduce, you know, the dopamine to try to make up for the fact that there are fewer of those dopamine-producing neurons in that circuit. But here's the thing. It also causes side effects. And those side effects are because dopamine is also a neurotransmitter in other parts of the brain.
Right. It's involved in memory, too.
Yeah. So the
big one... not want to not have dopamine. This seems like a bad idea. Just,
that's the point.
It's not even... It's flawed on every level, you know, in terms of how they think dopamine works. And so, you know, so the idea of detoxing from a neurotransmitter is nonsensical. But and then you might say, okay, that's just the buzzword, that the wellness buzzword, detox. But is there anything to avoiding activities which are addictive in order to sort of reset that reward circuitry? So let's look at that for a moment. So first of all, I think that is based upon a misconception as well, because it treats behavioral addiction this as if it were chemical addiction, and they're not the same thing.
No, they're not.
Yeah, you need to detox from a chemical addiction, you know, because the chemical itself is reinforcing your reward circuitry, and it's the responsiveness of your receptors to that chemical is what is being downgraded and what you need to reset. The same isn't true of the neurotransmitters that happen to be involved in the circuitry of the reward. It's not the same thing.
Well, and also, like, it's just it's so complicated. But, like, honestly, if you have a behavioral addiction, you need to make behavioral changes and cognitive
exactly.
changes, by the way.
Yeah.
But to be clear, even if you have a drug addiction, yes, you do need to detox, but you also need to make behavioral changes.
Totally, because it's both. Yeah, chemical yeah. addictions are both. They're yeah. chemical and behavioral. But mm-hmm. you can have behavioral addictions that are just behavioral.
Right,
and,
exactly.
Yeah, and that doesn't mean that there can't be medications that which might help you. Like you might use antidepressants or whatever that might be helpful and combined with cognitive behavioral therapy or whatever in order to change your behavior. But at their core, they are behavioral. That's kind of the mm-hmm. whole point. And they still involve like you making choices about how you're living your life. It's not the same thing as a chemical addiction where you have no control. And so the other layer here that I really dislike is the idea of blaming the brain for your behavior. You know, it's like my brain's doing this. I'm not doing this. Like trying to make this magical separation between the two.
I push back against that, not like for kind of like normal use, but I do think that can be an effective strategy for people who have severe mental illness, is externalizing the experience. So externalizing the depression, externalizing the anxiety
so
can be really helpful.
I agree with you. And as I was about to say, is that it goes both ways.
Yeah.
Because there are people who blame the person when it really is a brain problem, and people who blame the blame when it really is a behavior problem, like a choice
right.
problem. And you can't just assume that it's one or the other. But I think people decide which one it is because that's what they want it to be rather than because that's what makes sense or that's practical. And so, yeah, so if you have a major depression, for example, yeah, that's, you know, there's something going on with your brain chemistry. That's fair. If you have ADD, like this is famously ADD was blamed on bad parenting. It's not bad
right.
parenting. It's your brain hardwiring, right? But this is sort of the other problem, saying I'm a sex addict. It's not my fault or whatever. Like it's something to do with your brain rather than the life choices that you're making. That's,
there may be some in between with it. We
and
don't
there, it's,
know yet.
It's complicated but, because the brain is an organ of behavior and does
right.
interact with the environment. So it's not cleanly separated. But you know what I'm saying, Kara.
Yeah, if you're no, I know what you're saying.
Yeah, it's not just like a way of giving you more power over your issues. It's a way of absolving you of responsibility for your issues.
And even beyond that, it doesn't – like here's my thing. It doesn't work. Like if you tell somebody
yes.
who wants to lose weight, just stop eating for a few weeks
yeah.
and then you can just start eating again. Well, I know that that's not realistic, but this is yo-yo dieting, right?
Yeah,
people
yeah.
will go, okay, I'm just going to make this drastic change and then I'm going to go right back to how I was the minute I'm done, which is what a dopamine detox, I'm assuming,
yeah, it's
is
basically,
what they're talking about.
Instead of like, let me find out what my actual issues are and make
right.
some lifestyle changes that may be long-term work. Let's do this one crazy trick life hack thing. I'm going to do a dopamine detox, then I'm good, right? Then I can go back.
Right,
to
and then all of a sudden,
doing.
The like I'm going to throw my phone, I'm going to lock my phone in a box for
yeah.
a week, and then I'm going to unlock it, and I'm going to have a better relationship with my phone. Like, no, you're going to go right back to
right.
the addictive behaviors that you've already had. You have to learn healthier behaviors with your
exactly.
phone.
Exactly. Yes.
So is externalizing wrong then? Because I recently got into the habit of like when I do something stupid, like recently I left my coffee on the trunk of my car and I'm about to drive away. And I'm like, oh, Bob, you almost got me. Sorry. you punk. I got you this time. Trixie. Bob is Trixie. No. Is that good or is that bad?
Well, I think
it's complicated.
It can be good.
yeah.
It can be really bad. Like you don't want to – this is actually a funny argument within psychology circles is the idea of dissociation and trauma and its relationship. And there are some treatments, like internal family systems theory, which does not have a lot of good evidentiary support, that is all about saying the part of me that does this, you know, the whatever part of Bob left his coffee cup on the car, which can be really helpful for some people, but for people who tend towards dissociation, that's probably wildly dangerous. So it's complicated. It depends.
It's complicated.
On
right. There's a lot of nuance there.
I'm going to keep doing it because it's funny.
Here's the thing. Yeah. Does it help you?
It makes me laugh.
There you go.
Yeah, that's
and
good.
Whoever's I'm with, it makes Liz laugh.
And does it keep you from being too hard on yourself?
Yeah, I'm just being goofy.
Yeah, then it's good.
So, yeah, I mean, Kara, the thing is, as we both know, it's very nuanced. And again, I am all for understanding. I mean, I've talked often on the show, understanding our neurological selves, mm-hmm. right, in order to – first of all, not beat ourselves up for being human,
Right.
And also not try to be unrealistic about your goals or try to like brute force your way to what you want, your behavioral changes or whatever. Because it's good to recognize, I have frontal lobes and I have, my basic desires and this is how they interact. I find that all very helpful and it's true and it could lead to actual some practical things. But this sort of simplistic notion of, this is not me, it's my brain, regardless of what the reality is counterproductive.
To me, this whole digital detox, whatever I keep calling digital, dopamine detox thing is a brute force attempt at hacking.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
Right.
But it's not developing healthy coping skills.
Right. It's anything to avoid long-term actual work.
right.
Like, let's just do this again. It's the hack. This one quick hack rather than actual work. Which is like the entire self-help industry. Uh-huh. You know what I mean? It's like,
which is why so often I can't tell you how often people will come into the clinic and they'll sit down and we'll come up with we'll do the full intake and then we'll do our treatment plan and we'll come up with our goals. And four sessions later, I'll get a call from the parents like, "Is my kid fixed yet?"
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right.
And you're
like,
patience.
Yeah.
Right. That's not how this works. Also, your kid's not broken. There's a lot to talk about here. Right, but it is. It's a problem. We want the quick fix.
And, exactly.
That's tough, man.
Right. Dopamine detox.
It's not going to work. It's just
pushed all my buttons. All right.
Yeah, I can imagine.
All right, Kara, tell us about the effect of overprotective parents.
So a psychologist wrote this article. They cite a lot of evidence to try and formulate an argument, but the argument itself still, I think, does require some, not so much logical leaps. I think that he does make a relatively solid argument, but it's not like a study will ever tell you this. So you can bear that in mind, right? This is not the result of a single study. But basically, the argument that this psychologist is making is that modern young people, like children today, and really they start looking at the evidence from around the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond, are dealing with mental health issues in very, very large numbers, as we know. If you compare pre and post demographic information between those kind of decades, we definitely see that suicidality, depression, anxiety, loneliness, all of these things are more prevalent. Now, I do think it's important that we caveat the hell out of that. I think that we're better at taking this data down now. I think we're asking the right questions now when we used to not. I think people are more forthcoming with their mental state because there's less stigma around mental illness. And I also think that the world is more difficult. Like there are literally political and climate change, like there are existential concerns that teenagers and young adults are facing now that they weren't before. So we've got to remember that this all happens with a lot of variables. But basically, the author of this article is making the argument that safety and an overemphasis on safety is actually doing more harm than good. I think he goes a little too far to be like, this is what's responsible for the rise in anxiety and depression among teens. I don't know if I would make that argument, but it might be a variable that does contribute. So basically, this idea that good intentions of parents today who understand adverse childhood experiences, who understand that corporal punishment is detrimental to the mental health of their children, who understand, things that just our parents and our parents' parents and our parents' parents didn't understand, sometimes are swinging the pendulum so far, and sometimes that are so anxious and afraid themselves of the boogeyman.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can't think of a better way to put it, right? The news cycle is what it is. It's very different now than it was. Actually, cable news wasn't even really all that prevalent until, when was that, like the mid-90s?
Oh, I think late 80s, 80s.
Late 80s? Okay, yeah. Late 80s, early 90s is when most people were starting to watch cable news as opposed to just the nightly news, like on the, you know, the main channels, which was a completely different thing. And so, and you, it is actually interesting when you look at the sociological data and the crime statistics that even as crime rates went down kind of around that era, that fear and anxiety went up and coverage of crime went up significantly. And you saw this, this is written from both an American and a Canadian perspective. Obviously we can't speak to other countries. But so the idea here, the argument here is that if we obsess about safety with children, and I think we do see an outward effect of this. Like when I was growing up, you know, I hate to be that person, when I was a kid, but we would go outside and play.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, come back when the streetlights turn on. And my parents had no idea where we were. We didn't have cell phones. They couldn't get in touch with us. And we were not supervised. And I know that there's always a bias of things were better when I was a kid and we should do it the way we did when I was a kid. But it, the data actually do show that children don't do as much independent activity.
Mm-hmm.
Children are more often supervised by adults. And there's actually a delay in their utilization of more, I guess, mature slash adult slash independent life skills. Mm-hmm. So kids are driving later, kids are leaving the home later, and kids are identifying themselves as being more afraid. And sadly, that does seem to have an impact on their resiliency. And so as much as I think that this is a complex, nuanced argument that's maybe made a little bit too simple by this one particular article, I do think it's an important conversation to have. Mm-hmm. Our parenting styles affect our children. Not just our parenting styles, our social pressures affect our children.
Yeah.
And kids today are more anxious than kids ever were in the past.
Parenting styles definitely have shifted. I think the whole helicopter parent thing is absolutely real. And, you know, there's a lot of studies out there for that, but also just anecdotally from my end, because my wife and I have both been in, you know, higher education for 30 years. Mm-hmm. And you could, it's palpable. I mean, it's palpable. Mm. Parents of college students today do things that were unthinkable when I was going to college. I mean, you know, parents calling teachers about grades and tests. And
which is, by the way, illegal. Like, it's not illegal for the parents to call the teachers, but it's illegal for the college professors to release any of that data.
Yeah, but I'm just saying, like when I was at college, my parents had no idea what was going on.
They got
my grades once a semester, and that was
That's right. You saw a report card, though.
They had zero idea. They wouldn't even know who to call. Like, the idea that they would in any way meddle with my relationship with my teachers or how I was doing, it was just unthinkable.
Only if there was a serious problem.
Yeah, if there were, sure.
They had
if
a fight was, or something.
If there was, some kind of disaster or special needs or whatever, that's different. But I'm just talking about for a regular student, you know, doing whatever, doing their thing. It's just incredible. Mm-hmm. And just, again, my wife works in a counseling. Now she teaches, but when she was working in a college counseling office, parents would call them saying their roommate's being mean to them. Like, really? You're getting involved at that level with a 20-year-old?
I mean, here's what happens.
Yeah.
And we know this because there are actually studies that really, really interestingly and creatively tap into this. That, and I'm going to take this straight from a line straight from the article. Parental overprotection has been shown to foster unhealthy coping mechanisms in children.
Exactly.
Overprotected children tend towards depression, anxiety, and they also tend towards defiance, delinquency, and substance abuse.
Yeah, because they don't have the skills or the emotional resilience.
They can't cope.
Emotional regulation can be taught by offering, like mirroring. It can be taught by showing if parents have good emotional regulation, yes, their children are going to learn by seeing, but they also, and so don't get me wrong, that's like a huge part of teaching a kid good emotional regulation is you need to be good at emotional regulation.
Absolutely.
And when I say emotional regulation, I don't mean hiding your emotions. I mean, having healthy experiences with emotions, but they also have to learn by having their feelings. Mm-hmm. They have to experience things that are stressful in life, things that seem unsafe or feel unsafe, but actually aren't unsafe. And the problem is we are protecting children from even feeling that lack of safety. Mm-hmm. And so they don't know what to do when they are faced with actual unsafe things because they don't have any coping skills. And right. That's worrisome. It's really worrisome.
Yeah, I mean, it even penetrates into the education culture significantly, just parents. So, like, for example, I don't remember if I brought this up on the show before, but, like, the standard, you know, educational approach now is to not do anything that stresses out students. Because there's evidence that shows that they perform better or whatever, mm-hmm. you know, if you don't do anything that stresses them out. For example, like you shouldn't even ask a student a question that has a right or wrong answer, because they might suffer the stress of not knowing the answer or
but
being wrong.
That's not inherently stressful.
But I'm just saying that this is where we're at. I'm telling
right.
you what
it's
I was taught
correction.
To do.
Yeah.
Or how about this? You can't praise a student for doing a good job because that will make other students feel jealous or like, well, why am I not getting praised?
Well, and here's the real problem with this kind of thinking and this kind of rhetoric is it takes all agency away from good educators.
Yeah.
We know it's true that you can't single particular children out and constantly praise them at the risk of the other students always feeling like they're not seen. That's not healthy.
There's something there, absolutely.
Right, but a good educator doesn't need a directive so that they're scared to go outside of this really, really constrained rule.
Yeah.
A good educator has to use their best judgment. We need to teach them what happens psychologically
right.
when children are faced with these different experiences so that they can use good judgment in their teaching.
Not only that, I wonder about the difference between like an immediate effect versus a cumulative effect. Like, sure, that student may be happier now, but if over the course of their education, they never had to confront the prospect of being wrong.
Right.
That's just – it just seems to me that that's a problem, that that may have some negative consequences.
And I think the thing is like – so basically we can look at the literature and we can say, okay, children are going to – children often self-report negative experiences when their teachers do X, Y, and Z. And so then you know the educational system says teachers don't do X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
But that's very different than saying you know overcorrect in the other
right.
direction.
I think there's an overcorrection.
I think that's usually the problem. Like, for example, yes, we shouldn't stress kids out intentionally at school. Mm-hmm. Kids are stressed as it is. They are complete. Like, they are scheduled in a way that children were never scheduled previously. And the homework load is higher than it's ever been. The pressure to get into college is higher than it's ever been. And yes, stressing out a kid for the sake of stressing them out, which has been an educational strategy in the past,
yeah.
but being like, I'm going to toughen you up, boy.
Yeah.
Like, that is not healthy.
I agree. The Severus Snape approach doesn't work either.
It doesn't. Work, but being so afraid that anything being so afraid that anything will cause stress is also not appropriate. It's finding the balance. It's
a
nuance,
right? We need to get back to a balance. Yeah, I agree. You should take a nurturing approach. It's good to ask sort of open ended questions, and you know that, like, what do you think about this, and get mm-hmm. engaged rather than what we call pimping in medicine, which is just asking a bunch of factual questions, you know, like
just to
grilling,
like embarrass somebody.
Yeah,
for not,
grilling
yeah, exactly.
somebody. Have you memorized these facts? You know, I don't really even care about that. It's more about tell me what you think about this. I want to know that you.
Yeah,
can
you
think
critically
think
your way through this, and can we all as a group come up with like better solutions?
Yeah, that's
or,
all
yeah,
great.
That's
but
important.
Some answers are right and some are wrong. You know what
right,
I mean? Like,
that's true.
So,
too.
Or some are better than others, and it's okay to acknowledge that. Without and but again without judgment or shame. I mean that's the thing.
Right.
You want to take all the shame out of education, and you mm-hmm. want to be nurturing, but don't pretend like everybody wins and it's all good and there's no wrong answers. I mean that's a way overreaction that I think is extremely counterproductive.
And
like,
they're
real
cognitive
world
distortions.
Work that way.
Yeah, they're cognitive distortions. So this psychologist identifies three, you know, cognitive distortions. There are so many out there. We can slice and dice the pie however we want. We do it all the time on the show. But in this particular write-up, they identified three cognitive distortions: negative filtering. So basically, you know, a parent going, it's too dangerous for my kid to go outside because what if they get kidnapped? But they're not thinking about how actually healthy it is for the kid to be independent, to be able to solve problems, to develop risk assessment skills, to experience joy, right? Like they're only looking at the negative consequences of things. So we've got to be careful that we also look at the positive. They also identify the just being, and we basically touched on this without saying it explicitly, dichotomous thinking. Right. Either that thing is good or that thing is bad. I'm sorry. It's almost never that simple. There's always nuance. They have both.
Yeah. There's a good analogy to be drawn to the cleanliness thing. The idea that everything has got to be, you know, absolutely sterile. Kids don't get exposed to any germs because otherwise they'll get sick. It's like, yeah, but now you're hampering their immune system.
Yep.
It's actually a good thing to give, we don't want to, you know, don't inject them with Ebola or whatever, but... Getting exposed to the normal background level of germs is a good and healthy thing. It's the same thing.
It's the exact same thing. And the problem is that a lot of people listen to that rhetoric and they overcorrect and they want to inject their kid with mental Ebola.
Yeah.
And I think that's the other issue, right? Is this argument that we don't want it to be so sterile. We need to let them live in the world. We don't need to toughen them up. We don't need to force dangerous or negative experiences on them to, quote, make them resilient. The world is hard. Mm-hmm. They are going to be facing cruelty, unfairness, difficulty every day of their lives just by virtue of being alive and being around other kids. So we should be fostering in them independence and security. Let's help them feel safe.
Exactly.
And the way that we help them feel safe is by knowing that there's a place that they can come where they can talk to us when they're ready, when they want to, and we can help them navigate those issues. It's not about protecting them from ever feeling anything.
Exactly. Don't shield them from the world. Give them the skills to deal with it.
We know how this works with like sex education.
Yeah.
It doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
Like the evidence shows it doesn't.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Bob, tell us about these shock bosons.
Interesting way to put it, but okay. Researchers released an updated estimate of the mass of an important particle in physics called the W boson. That mass estimate is very close to what our best theories predict it should be, and that just sucks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, why? Because there's nothing special.
Why does it suck?
There's nothing to learn.
We shall see. First, though, what is a W boson? Yeah, we've mentioned it a couple times, but definitely a refresher would be nice. These particles mediate one of the classic four fundamental forces of nature, the weak force. They're said to carry the force, like the photon carries the electromagnetic force. The weak force, though, in my eyes, is the redheaded stepchild of forces.
Hey.
Is that expression not cool anymore?
I
actually don't know. It's like
me neither. Like, let's look into that.
it's probably racist on some level.
I don't know. I think it's probably racist. I think it's
hair,
just more about like cheating.
It's something.
I don't know. Whatever. Okay. Move on.
The point is, I don't think the weak force is on anyone's favorite force list. And I, of course, most people should have a favorite force list because why not? So it's not cool like the strong force, which is basically the Superman of forces, right? What's not to like about the strong force? The electromagnetic force is my favorite since it makes glorious light in all of its forms from gamma rays all the way to radio waves. It's always enthralled me since I was a kid. The final fundamental force, gravity, is just wonderful, right? It's distinct and mysterious, and it shapes the universe itself. What's not to love about the gravity? Mm-hmm. Compared to them, the weak force kind of has an impossible task, right? But it is critically important beyond measure and fascinating in its own right. It's responsible for some types of radioactive decay, which drive the nuclear furnaces of stars. And life as we know it just would not exist without it, to name just a couple of ways that it's incredibly important. Now, W boson's precise mass is actually pretty important, too, because since it could help us refine and test what one physicist called probably the most successful scientific theory that's ever been written down, the Standard Model of Physics, which I've mentioned many times on the show. It describes the fundamentals of the known universe at the beautifully basic level of interacting forces and particles. The model has been basically bulletproof for decades. It just shrugs off any theoretical onslaught that has tried to discredit it. It's amazingly successful. But the Standard Model's last major prediction, what was the last major prediction?
The Higgs boson? That,
I remember talking about it at TAM 11 years ago in 2012, and holy crap, that was 11 years ago. Damn. All right. So now we know the standard model is complete, though. As awesome as it is, it doesn't predict important things like dark matter or dark energy, the ever-increasing expansion of the universe, and even gravity itself has never fallen out of the standard model's equations, not even mentioned in there. So clearly, this is a partial model of the reality as we know it. So this is why when Fermilab's physicist reported the most precise measurement of the mass of W bosons last year, it really caused like a ruckus because it calculated a mass far more than what the standard model itself predicted. And this new measurement was compelling. It's not like they asked ChatGPT what the mass was. They actually worked with 400 scientists worldwide over a decade, and they went through 4 million potential W boson particle candidates that were created by 450 trillion collisions at the Tevatron Collider. So they did some homework. They did some serious homework over 10 years. They also claimed that they had the most precise measurement yet, to 1.01%, twice the precision of previous efforts. So now that was exciting. It was exciting. And some people, of course, said, all right, calm down. You know, this is still kind of like, it's not definitive. But it was exciting, especially to me, because it could mean that we finally found the chink in the standard model's armor. Such a large mass could mean, for example, that there's maybe a new particle or force out there that could be causing this extra higher mass than we anticipated. And that could be the first solid evidence of physics beyond the standard model, which I've been crowing about for many years, something we've been searching for. The big fear nowadays, I think, is that the energy regime that we would need to engage with in order to encounter new physics, maybe it's so far beyond humanity's technological prowess that it could be generations, decades, or 100 years before we actually can build something that could illuminate, you know, new physics for us. That's the big fear, is like that we are now in a dead zone, a desert of physics, of particle physics, where the LHC or anything even much more powerful is just not powerful enough to reveal what needs to be revealed. So that's what's scary to me. It's like, oh man, no new physics for a really long time.
Let me ask you a question. So the quote-unquote shock boson that I talked about at the beginning was in the title of the paper, or at least the recording of it. Is that the W boson? That's just a fancy way of saying the W boson. Or is that I thought it was some other boson they were talking about.
No. I think you just misread the title. Let me see.
There's no comma after shock. It's not like shock boson result. You know, it says shock boson result. Why does it
no
say
money
that
down.
In the headline?
No, money down.
Yeah, I mean, just an unusual way for them to describe it.
But they're talking about the W boson. It's just bad headline writing. Okay. Yep. Go ahead.
It's like that. Yeah. It's like the Higgs. It's like God particle discovered. It's
right. All right.
Why?
Okay.
The equivalent of the God particle. Gotcha.
Mm-hmm. Yep. The new and disappointing bit now is the ATLAS collaboration at CERN's LHC, Large Hadron Collider. They've reanalyzed their own boson data that they took years ago, and they've improved their estimate. Based on this reassessment, they improved their estimate of its mass. And they say that their new estimate is 16% more precise than their previous estimate. Let me just say what these estimates are then. So the standard model, right? The standard model predicts a mass for the W boson at 80.357 GeV, or giga electron volts. So 80.357. Fermilab predicted it at 80.433 giga electron volts. So from 83.
Well, they measured it, not predicted it.
They measured it. Their estimate, you know, plus or minus the error bars, is 80.433. Now, standard model was 80.357. So it's, you know, it's definitely heavier. The LHC ATLAS estimate puts it at 80.360, which is just a tiny bit above the 80.357 of the standard model. So they're really close, really, really close to what's predicted. So it just fits right in there. It's just really just a 3/3000th of a GeV away. The Tevatron Fermilab numbers seem close, right? It's just like less than one, right? But you know, it's still like 80 thousandths of a GeV. That is a big difference. It seems tiny, but we're, you know, The G in GEV stands for giga. I mean, this is it's a lot. It's a lot. And that would be dramatic if it's true because it's so different from the standard model. So now this doesn't mean that the Atlas prediction or the estimate is correct and Fermilab is wrong. There's nothing definitive being said here at this point. Fermilab proponents say that after all, the Atlas number is a refinement of their earlier number, which was close to the standard model's prediction anyway. So nobody was really thinking that they were going to be dramatically change that estimate. So that's not really a huge surprise. That's kind of what Fermilab people are saying, as far as I could tell. There's also the fact that this new number is also their – it's their preliminary number estimate. It's not the official number yet. But, of course, I don't think when it becomes official, it's going to be dramatically different than what they've already released. So the general consensus seems to be that the large mass estimate from Fermilab – from 2022 seems less likely to be correct now that this new estimate has been released. People are definitely not as hopeful as they were before. But of course, time will tell with this one. Rigorous review is still needed to happen with the new Atlas number. So there's always the chance that there's some kind of fundamental problem that makes their estimate, you know, unreliable. I guess that's possible. Then there's also other experiments in the near future that are going to refine even further. And there's even some proposed new electron-positron collider ideas that would be even better at measuring the W boson's mass because they'd be specifically created to do that very, very well. I'm disappointed that this new possible discovery of new physics is less likely now, but we'll see, you know, once the vetting process is over, what the experts are saying. And I'll still have hope in the future that we can see some brand new physics out there, at least something that will help explain dark matter and dark energy and gravity, because the standard model is not doing that at all. So that's where I am.
So the standard model is still a useful tool, but a cruel tyrant at the same time.
It is. It is. And it's like, what is it? 94% of the universe has nothing to say about. Like, wait, what about all this extra stuff over here that we recently discovered? What do you say about that? I'm agnostic. I say nothing about it. It's frustrating. And I just want some answers, goddammit.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Evan, is it helpful or isn't it helpful to drink moderate amounts of alcohol? It seems like this is an endless question.
Yeah, endless question. And certainly, I think something perhaps all of us have heard or is in sort of common parlance that, yeah, a little bit of alcohol, hey, that's good for you. And a little drink of wine
for
here,
years,
right?
For years, a little bit, just a drink a day or whatever.
And if you go online, yeah, and if you go online and actually go to some, you know, reputable places, they may actually back that up. I went to the Mayo Clinic website. Here's what they had to say about it. Under their header, pros and cons of moderate alcohol use, moderate alcohol consumption may provide some health benefits, such as reducing your risk of developing and dying of heart disease, possibly reducing your risk of stroke, possibly reducing your risk of diabetes. Okay. You can go to WebMD. WebMD has some things in which they say, oh, surprising ways alcohol may be good for you. If you're in good shape, moderate drinking makes you 25% to 40% less likely to have a heart attack, stroke,
or hardening
of arteries. This may be in part because small amounts of alcohol can raise your HDL, which is the good cholesterol, raise your HDL levels. Okay. And there are plenty of other sort of reputable places you can go to see similar stuff now. And also, oh, by the way, in more recent times, wine, particularly red wine, developed a reputation for having health benefits because news stories have highlighted their high concentrations of a protective antioxidant.
Resveratrol.
Yes, resveratrol.
Oh, yeah.
I love that.
Found in blueberries and cranberries, of course. We've talked about antioxidants.
Oh, my God. Why is that still in the news?
Did you know that this idea has been around for 100 years? Mm-hmm. It dates back to 1924. There was a biologist at Johns Hopkins named Raymond Pearl. Steve, didn't you go to Johns Hopkins?
I did.
Coincidence? I think not. But in any case, Raymond Pearl published a graph with a J-shaped curve. I had the letter J. So picture that in your mind. The starting point at the left side is elevated, representing abstinence from alcohol. Then the curve goes down, hitting the low point in the middle, representing the moderate drinkers, who supposedly had the lowest rates of mortality from all causes. And then sure enough, when you get past that moderation, zoom, the curve rockets upward, signifying what is, well, what we understand is heavy alcohol consumption, and it increases your mortality a lot and reduces lifespan. The effects of alcohol, they've been scientifically studied now for many decades. And while some research in that time has synced up with the moderate alcohol consumption can be somewhat healthy understanding that a lot of us have, but there have also been other studies that say the opposite's true, that there are actually no health benefits to any levels of consuming alcohol. Okay, so what's going on here? Well, there's been a new analysis published recently in JAMA Network Open, and they looked at more than 40 years of research. And they concluded that many of those studies which showed some health benefits for moderate alcohol consumption, they were flawed. Yep. The researchers analyzed more than 100 studies which had 5 million adults within those 100 studies. And they were able to identify and correct for methodological problems that plagued many of the older observational studies. And these reports that they evaluated, well, the reports themselves consistently found that, man, moderate drinkers, they're less likely to die of all causes, including those not related to alcohol consumption. That sounds good, right? But here's the thing. Most of the studies, observational that they are, it meant that they could identify links or associations, but could be misleading. It did not prove cause and effect. The scientists said that these older studies failed to recognize that light and moderate drinkers had a lot of other healthy habits and advantages, and that the people in the groups that they looked at who would abstain from alcohol, well, guess what? They were actually former drinkers who gave up alcohol after developing health problems. So, So basically, many people, the people in the study deemed to be the non-alcohol users are former alcohol users.
Well, some of them are.
Health issues. Some of them are.
Some of them are, and contaminates the data.
I bet it's a pretty big percentage.
I mean, and I say this anecdotally as a non-drinker, and I know, Steve, that you don't drink either. But I say this anecdotally, and maybe it's because of my age and my cohort and all that. But when I'm out and somebody buys me a drink, offers me a drink, and I say, no, I don't drink, they always say, they always are like, oh, why? Like,
yeah,
you got a problem. It triggers something.
Right.
Yeah, like,
So the assumption is that if you don't drink, it's because you had a problem with alcohol. And it makes me really wonder, like, what percentage of people out there just don't drink and never really did?
It's low.
I bet you it's quite small.
It's low. According to the researchers who actually did look at that, they said people who abstain completely from alcohol are a minority. I didn't read the study enough to find out the exact number, but they said absolutely, definitely minority of people fall into that category who are teetotalers, 100%. Former alcohol users, they already developed their health issues. At some point, they stopped drinking, but the damage was done. So if you're going to compare a group of already damaged non-drinkers to moderate drinkers, yeah, that's going to look like the moderate group is healthier. But that's not true. And Tim Stockwell, he's a scientist with the Canadian Institute for Substance Use Research, and he was one of the authors on the report. He said that when he and his colleagues corrected for these kinds of errors, he said, lo and behold, the supposed health benefits of drinking shrink dramatically and become non-statistically significant. So, and there's other factors as well. You know, those who drink did have other health problems, and you know, there's socioeconomic factors as well. People who struggle with disabilities who also drink. So, there's a wider sort of group of people who drink for whatever reasons that they drink, that they go on, and hence the people who completely abstain, relatively small group. Mm-hmm. Moderate drinkers tend to be moderate in lots of different ways, not just in their drinking, but they also have, they tend to be, you know, middle to upper class in a sense, you know, wealthier. They have decent economic means. They're more likely to exercise, to eat healthy diets, and less likely to be overweight, and better hygiene, including oral hygiene that they found. So the moderate alcohol hypothesis certainly has come under more criticism over the years. And
because there's not really a plausible mechanism. No. Really? They think it's the resveratrol?
That's what they said.
That was the idea, that it was something in the alcohol. Or alcohol itself, like might lower cholesterol or whatever. So, but they've explored all these options and nothing ever came of it.
And any benefit like that is like significantly outweighed by the risks of the alcohol. Yeah,
that's right. And they say, including just red wine, it can contribute to cancers, breast cancer, breast cancer, esophageal cancer, high blood pressure, and heart arrhythmia. So those are the things that the newer studies now, the better studies, in fact, are finding that come along with studying things just red wine, not even, you know, the really harder liquors that are out there that people consume.
So Evan, though, but I have to say, I heard this 15 years ago.
Right.
The idea that the non-drinker cohort was contaminated by former drinkers. So this is not a new idea. This problem with the observational data as a confounding factor has been around for a long time, at least 10 to 15 years. So I'm not surprised. I mean, it's always hard to do these kind of observational studies because it's really, by definition, it's hard to control for confounding factors. And this has been this sort of back and forth open question for decades. So this is like just the latest salvo in a long story. You know what I mean?
Right. Because clearly, like a lot of the researchers who are continuing to do these studies didn't get that memo. Mm-hmm. And so there's like 10 to 15 years of more research to be looking at these meta-analyses of, or these, you know, just these studies basically in general of, to have to then re-debunk.
Yeah, right.
Which is frustrating.
Well, right, because it's in the social conscious right now that exists. Yeah. Most people believe that it's that there are no negative health consequences with moderate drinking.
And maybe even positive ones.
And some positive effects, right.
The public consciousness is different, though, than researchers who should be up on the literature. I think they mostly are. I just think it was just not a completely closed question. And some of them may have missed the memo, Kara, as you say, like they didn't realize that this issue was already brought up before. Because this is a complicated area of research. But I wasn't surprised to see this at all. It's like that's basically what I've been assuming for the last 15 years since I read the earlier summaries of the research. Like, once you factor out the non-drinkers, the benefits all go away.
I got in an argument the other day with somebody because I drank a Coke in front of them.
Oh,
like
no.
Like a Coke. And they were like, oh my God, it's so full of toxins. It's so bad for you, blah, 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 blah. Which don't get me wrong. It's way too much sugar. It's not healthy to drink all that sugar, right? Mm-hmm. I was drinking a full sugar Mexican Coke. It's my favorite thing in the world. Give me a vice. I don't have any vices. Let me have this. But he was like going hard. And I was like, you just drank two beers. Like, I don't understand. And it's so funny. It's so common for me to hear this from people like, Mexican Coke, that shit'll kill you. And they're like drinking alcohol right in front of me. And I'm like, that has almost the same amount of sugar and also is bad for your liver.
Mm.
How are we still having this conversation?
Right. Not to mention the inebriation effects.
Oh, my God. I don't know. Beer is not a health food, people.
No, I mean, look. Hey,
I know Coke isn't a health food either, but neither is beer.
Well, I don't know. What I've also heard, and I know we're off on a little tangent here, is that, in the Middle Ages, maybe, the beer was healthier to drink than the water because you'd get dysentery from the water? And
part of the reason I got on my Coca-Cola problem is that I travel internationally so much. And sometimes, yes, Coca-Cola is healthier to drink. It's not healthier in the sense that it is good for you. It's healthier in the sense that you're not going to get an intestinal parasite or an illness from drinking that. Yeah, there are places in this world where you have to be careful. You can only drink water if it's been boiled. So, you know, tea, coffee, usually fine. Reconstituted juices, straight water out of the tap, not okay. So if you don't have bottled water in front of you, I'm going to drink a Coke.
All right, let's go on. We're going to do – there's no – who's that noisy? Because Jay's not here. So I'm just going to do one name not logical fallacy, and then we're going to go on with our interview. We have an interview with the COO of Amprius, the battery company who had that exciting announcement. We're going to get into some technical details. It's a really fun interview. But first, this email comes from Bob Compare, C-O-M-P-E-R-E, Compare. Mm. I don't know, what do you think? My favorite segment of the show is Name That Logical Fallacy, of course. I almost never get it right, but I...
Neither do we.
But I think those discussions are super interesting and fun. I wish it was a standard part of every episode. Well, we'll take it under advisement. Anyways, I listened to the recent AI debate with the fellow formerly from Google. He stated that the Google AI was sentient because it seemed to deviate from the parameters that had been defined to control its behavior. That sounds to me like the classic false dichotomy. You cannot explain something, so my explanation must be true. It's very similar to the argument you get from religion. Where and how did life arise? Science answers that. We do not know yet, and the religious debater immediately says, you can't explain it, therefore Jesus, QED. The conclusion is reached with no proof and no alternative is considered, even though a vast array of equally or more, or often more plausible mechanisms could be responsible. Thanks for the great show. Keep up the good work. And yes, I am signing up as a patron right now. Well, thanks, Bob.
Oh, thank you.
So what do you guys think? He sort of does a quick, he hits on a couple of logical fallacies in here. I'm not sure any of them are the false dichotomy, but you know, he's getting close there. So what's the fallacy? So I'll say this, he's committing a fallacy himself, but you had
Who
to
is Bob?
You had yeah, Bob, but you had to listen to the interview to know what fallacy he's committing. I'll give you a hint there. But let's first focus on this idea that this is the false dichotomy of if you can't explain something, this other explanation must be true. Is that really what a false dichotomy is?
No.
False dichotomy is either or the only options.
Right. I mean, he's sort of framing it that way, which it just shows you how you could frame logic to make it sound like anything. But so I think what he's really referring to is the false choice, which is a sort of false dichotomy. It doesn't mean that there's only, like, it's either 100% black or 100% white. They're just saying, all right, we got these two options, and if it's not A, it's got to be B. Or, you know, it is prematurely limiting the number of possibilities. But what he's describing also includes the argument from ignorance, right? We don't know what this is, therefore Jesus, right? You can't explain it, therefore Jesus. That's an argument from ignorance. That's not a false dichotomy.
And also, to me, I actually use this term during the interview, I think, if I'm remembering correctly. One informal logical fallacy that's used quite often is the burden of proof logical fallacy. It's saying that the burden lies not on the person that's making the claim, but on somebody else to disprove. And he fully committed to that logical fallacy. And I even called it out.
Yeah.
Like, I think we're talking past each other because we're saying that the other has the burden of proof.
I agree with that. But to be fair to Blake, who's what we're talking about.
Yes.
He didn't say what Bob said he said. So there's a straw man. His whole email's a straw man.
Right.
Which I explained to him and he agreed once I explained to him. But so what Blake was saying was that.
Yeah, so
I agree that Blake was sort of shifting the burden of proof a little bit. But it was really when we pushed him, what he says is, listen, what I'm saying is that the behavior of Lambda, right, the AI that he was querying, can be explained if it were sentient. And that doesn't prove it is sentient, but I think that Occam's razor favors that explanation, and the alternative is solipsism.
And he did make that argument.
That's where he was wrong.
And I think we should get into that. But to be fair, he also did say multiple times, I think that sentience is the best possible explanation, and Google has not given me another explanation.
Yeah, I agree.
He kept pushing the burden of proof onto Google.
Right, but when you pushed him, he said Occam's razor and solipsism.
Right, that was like his secondary.
Yeah, so that's why we had to destroy those logical pillars of his position. Nope, Occam's razor doesn't favor your position. And no, it isn't solipsism because we're not just saying that I can't prove something else is sentient based on its behavior. I could look at its architecture and say it's not functioning as something that is sentient.
Right.
I know
that was his biggest mistake.
Yeah,
I think.
I think so.
For sure, the most important mistakes.
So, anyway, so I thought he didn't say it has to be sentient because it deviated from its behavior. He didn't say it that way. That was a straw man.
He did say that there were potential other possible explanations. He just thinks this is the best one, and he hasn't heard one that's better.
Yeah, I offered him one that's better. So when I wrote about it the next day, because it's always like you have to process the whole thing in your head, and get more efficient at explaining, you know, what my position is. I think the best way to explain it is that, you know, he was saying that this software, which was basically designed to mimic sentience, was actually sentient, and it wasn't just mimicking sentience really well, even though that's what it was actually programmed to do. So obviously Occam's razor would favor saying, well, this program that was meant specifically to mimic sentience is mimicking sentience. The other thing is the explanation for the deviated from its programming explanation is he basically gave the answer. He said, the software is programmed to please you. It's also programmed not to discuss religion. So I pushed one parameter.
One of them went out.
Yeah, I pushed it until it broke the other one. He said that's what he did. I kept pushing and pushing and pushing the shaming and whatever, the please me angle, until it overrode the don't talk about religion imperative. So of course it did. You pushed it until it broke. You know, it had two conflicting directives, and you pushed one till it overrode the other. That's the explanation. It doesn't have to be sentient in order to explain that.
That's why Hal killed people.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
Yeah, that is true.
He was given conflicting instructions, and he went a little cray cray. All right.
But he also wanted to, no?
Well, no.
Well, I'm not going to get into that.
If you, so in 2001, Kara,
you did it.
Bob did it too. You can't bring up 2001 and not me have you talk about it.
You can't walk away from this.
Oh, it's more 2010 than
2001. Well, I know. That's you're getting to my point. In 2001, it's completely ambiguous. We don't know why HAL 9000 breaks. That's kind of the point, is that we don't know
why. It is kind of the
point,
but we're also meant to feel a certain kind of way.
Yeah, you kind of feel sorry for him at the end, you know. But then in 2010, they explained it all.
Right.
And some people think that they shouldn't have done that. It was better to leave it.
Yeah, it's like, midichlorians are the force. Really?
Crap.
For me, my version of that is so off topic, but my example of that is Pan's Labyrinth.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I just wanted to know, it should have been left open. Is this a place she was going in her head in order to escape the brutality of war?
Mm-hmm.
Or was the fantasy land actually real? And I don't think they did a good enough job. I feel like they buttoned it up too well at the end of that.
Mm-hmm.
I wish they would have left it open. Sorry.
Unlike Total Recall, where it was wonderfully ambiguous whether or not he was really in a psychotic break in a simulation, or if he really was a sleeper agent that was got.
Well, it was wonderfully ambiguous, but I think there was one big tell that kind of decides it.
Yeah, but I agree.
Yeah, we've talked about this in the past.
Should I mention Highlander, or is that going too far?
Oh, my God.
Same idea.
And Steve, you said Hal was cray-cray, but I think you're wrong because Hal was not based on the Cray supercomputer architecture.
Yeah, you're right.
Clever, Bob. Very clever.
Thank you.
All right, let's go on with our interview. We are joined now by John Bornstein. John, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thanks for having me.
So, John, it says here that you are the chief operating officer for Amprius Technologies. We spoke about your press release from a couple weeks ago, and I wanted a lot more information than I could find online, so you kindly agreed to come on the show and answer our many pesky questions. So why don't you tell us first, what's the deal with this new Amprius 500 watt-hour per kilogram battery that you have?
So Amprius has developed and is shipping product for high-performance applications. The product is lithium-ion cells, and the fundamental differentiator is the silicon anode. We have a unique silicon anode that enables very high energy density. Silicon has 10 times more capacity than carbon, which is the incumbent material in everybody's lithium-ion cell, the one that's in your cell phone, in your car, in basically anything that is running on batteries today. And as a result, if you can do it right, if you can solve the fundamental problem of silicon, then you can exploit tremendous advantages in energy density. And so that's what we've done. We've solved a fundamental problem, which is that silicon swells when it's charged with lithium. And after a few charge-discharge cycles, that swelling leads to essentially cracking. And cracking means that you're no longer passing charge and your battery's dead. And that has limited the sort of deployment of silicon. And there have been a lot of efforts to overcome that. And we overcame that with a concept that came out of Stanford University in around 2006, 2007. And then we perfected it and have a product that we're shipping today.
Yeah, I was just talking to Evan before the interview that I remembered this from our news items from like whatever it was 10 years ago. I guess it was longer because we do talk on the show about emerging technology and often how it's 5 to 10 years away or They just have to fix this one thing, and this is going to revolutionize battery technology. So this is it. Here we are 16 whatever years later. That's how long it took to crack the cracking problem.
Indeed. That's right. And it's basically a nanotechnology Ooh. Solution. And at one time, that was a real buzzword. And and I guess it still is to some extent. It's added to the lexicon of buzzwords. But really, it's become a real solution. And we're exploiting that solution, as I said, and we're enabling products that wouldn't really be viable without the energy density that we bring to it. And we bring other things. Silicon also has a feature wherein you can get high discharge rates, and i.e. high current, and retain high energy. And you can do both high discharge and high charge. So mm-hmm. one of the things that we've demonstrated is what's called extreme fast charge. What that means is that in our cell, we demonstrated and published that we can charge from 0 to 80% in 6 minutes.
Whoa.
Wow.
Amazing.
So that really changes the sort of paradigm, if you will, on what it means to recharge things that run off of batteries.
But let me ask you, does that degrade the life time, the life cycle of the battery at all?
That's a great question. And the short answer is not really. The protocol for that is not a simple high, you know, current charge. You charge it high at first when it's at a low state of charge, and then you sort of taper off. And so you can preserve the cycle life, as it's called, the number of charge discharge cycles, mm-hmm. by doing the charging in a mode that doesn't overwhelm it, if you will. And we've demonstrated that.
So would that be the right. standard way to charge then, or would that just be still for special occasions where you want to get to 80% within 6 minutes? Is there
It could be the standard. It could be the standard. And we demonstrated that without preconditioning the cell. If you precondition it, if anyone drives a Tesla or other electric vehicle, you'll see when you're sort of mapping in a charging station, it says, I'm preconditioning your cells, your battery pack for you. That means it's heating them up, because when batteries are warm, they're lower impedance. They have less resistance. And as a result, they'll charge faster. We did this at room temperature, and still got a very, very, I would say, impressive result.
And there's just, I'll ask a blanket question. There's no gotchas here in terms of, is there anything about this battery that's not as good as the, say, the lithium ion batteries that are in a Tesla at this point in time, in terms of all of the features that we like? It's not going to blow up and catch fire. You know, it's, you know, the battery life's not going to degrade really, really quickly.
So that's a great question, and let me answer it as follows. It's as safe as any other lithium-ion cell, which means that it is subject, like any lithium-ion cell, to thermal runaway. It can catch fire. However, we've come up with a solution for thermal runaway for a product that we've developed for the U.S. Army. It's a wearable that a soldier wears in his or her vest to power all the electronics that the modern soldier carries. And one of the things you have to pass in an application like that is nail penetration. And of course, ultimately, some kind of projectile, a bullet. And we've demonstrated that we can pass a nail penetration test. So it turns out that we've got a solution that gets us even better than most lithium-ion cells today for things like nail penetration.
Wow.
I'll add also, though, that we're not an exotic cell insofar as the manufacturing and the bill of materials that are used. We leverage the entire global supply chain for all of the components that go into our cell. In other words, the cathode, the separator, the electrolyte, etc. That's all stuff off the shelf, as is the assembly equipment. The only thing we change is the anode. So we're an anode replacement solution. So everything that is state-of-the-art today, or even, let's say, cutting edge, is what we can take advantage of, and we do. So we're very similar, therefore, to the attributes that just about every other lithium-ion cell has with respect to most other properties, except we really bring high fast, high charge, fast discharge, and of course, high energy density, as we've made a point of.
Yeah, so basically, just to make sure the audience understands what we're talking about, these things, they have the 500 watt hour per kilogram. That's about twice what would be in a Tesla.
Correct.
At this point. And same for that's for weight, but same for volume, right? It's about twice the density in terms of volume.
Yeah, so that's right. The Tesla 4680, which is a cylindrical cell, that's their state of the art, is about 630 watt hour per liter. We have about 1300 watt hours per liter in our cell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Now, you said at the top that this is for high-end applications. Does that mean it's more expensive than like a per, you know, storage for like a, compared to the production electric vehicle batteries that are out there now?
Well, with high performance, you get to charge a premium. And so we certainly enjoy that differential. At scale, our cost is pretty much parity with typical mass production costs. The big difference, of course, is silicon that we replace carbon with. And silicon is the second most abundant element on the planet. There's no shortage of silicon. In fact, it's probably more environmentally friendly than graphite. You mine graphite, it's a petroleum product, so you can also synthesize it. It's not necessarily a clean process. So silicon is cleaner, and it's derived from sand, which is plentiful, as I said. So at scale, and when I say scale, I mean gigawatt hour, which is sort of where you have to be competitive. We're parity with conventional processes.
So how long is it going to be before you are producing this type of battery for electric vehicles?
Great question. We are producing for electric vehicles today, but they're not terrestrial. They're flying electric vehicles.
Mm-hmm. Oh, so, nice. Propeller planes.
Yes, indeed. So that's the high performance I was talking about.
Nice.
You know, if you have high energy density, in particular, what's called high gravimetric energy density, as we have with a 500 watt hour per kilogram cell, then that is tremendously important for things that fly. You want a lot of energy in as little weight as possible so that you can, you know, take advantage of the payload that you have to carry and also, of course, have a bigger airplane potentially. And that's where we come in because we don't only solve the energy equation, we also enable power. So when an electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft takes off, it's got to pull a lot of power, and then you want to have energy for a long cruise, and then you got to land again, and you've got to have power. And that's what we brought to the equation. We have both high energy and high power, and it really is enabling for these high-performance aircraft. But we're already shipping today for drones. That's our big market. High-altitude drones, we have enabled Airbus to break world records on endurance on their solar electric high altitude pseudo satellite. We're also enabling very long mission time for drones that the military uses. And so for today's capacity that we have, we're just going from pilot to mass production. We can supply these sort of high performance smaller markets as a way to seed the market and then grow into mainstream as we expand our manufacturing footprint.
Yeah, I know. I was reading that you're building, is it in Colorado, you're building a new factory?
That's right.
Is that going to be for the drones, or might that be for cars, or is there a plan? Is somebody you talking to Tesla or somebody about a production battery for a car?
So we're certainly leveraging and building out our footprint in the aerospace market, and we've got tremendous demand for that, and that's why we have announced that we're expanding our capacity and building out this facility in Brighton, Colorado. So we're going to serve that market and expand that market, and then when we get to the sort of tens of gigawatt hour, which we're projecting somewhere after 2025, that's when we start addressing and supplying to the electric vehicle market. In the meantime, we're, of course, engaged with EV OEMs, mm-hmm. and we have a technical dialogue at this stage, and we expect that by that time frame that I just mentioned, 26 time frame, we'll start to get into the commercial engagement.
So before anybody could reasonably expect to have one of these batteries in a car, it'd be 2026 or later?
That's right.
Yeah.
I got a question.
Go ahead, Bob.
What do you envision, say 10 years, 8 to 10 years from now, do you envision any improvements? Does this, the silicon anode, lend itself to a type of improvement that you think you can get? Or, I mean, as the battery's amazing as it is right now, I don't even, you know, leaving it as is would be wonderful because it's such a huge improvement. But is there wiggle room for squeezing out even more energy density or even faster or slower, quicker charge times or discharge cycles or anything like that?
That's a great question. And the short answer is yes, there is headroom. And let me explain that, and I'll have to get into the weeds to explain that. Silicon, when you think about its fundamental properties relative to storing lithium, it can be explained in electrochemical terms as charge per unit mass or milliamp hours per gram. And so the number for that is around 3,300 milliamp hour per gram. Now let's compare that to graphite, which is around 350, 360. So there's almost a 10x increase in the capacity of silicon relative to graphite for storing lithium. That's at the material level. And then, you have to assemble that into a battery, and you have to have a cathode that supplies the lithium. And when all is said and done with the cathodes that are available today, we can demonstrate, because we have all this capacity in silicon, 500. But we're not using all of the capacity. We're using roughly about half, almost two-thirds. We can use more of it, but it takes advances in cathode for us to take advantage of our silicon to a greater extent. And so that's what we've been doing. So if you look at our sort of backward-looking roadmap, we've been advancing as cathodes have advanced. And why silicon is so important is you can't do anything with graphite relative to advancements in cathodes. They're stuck. They've topped out, and they topped out quite a while ago. And that's where silicon comes in. It's a fundamental material change. In the battery world, in order for you to advance performance, it's a very hard problem because it's chemistry and material science. You know, unlike the things that they're powering generally, for example, in microelectronics, it's a photolithography shrink. You don't have that going for you in batteries. And so it's fundamental material science and chemistry. And silicon is that solution. And we've got headroom, as I mentioned, cathode continued to advance, and we can take more advantage of silicon.
So would you say, from what you're saying, it sounds like that there's the potential at least to maybe double again the energy density?
There certainly is potential. Our roadmap is now focused on advances up to 600, and we can see a path to 700.
That would be incredible. And are you at liberty to say if you have any of this other sort of lab-based technology, battery technology, in the pipeline that as this plays out, maybe by 2028, 2030, we might be expecting some other sort of material revolution in battery technology?
So the short answer is that we can demonstrate something much higher than 500 today, but the materials are not yet stable, so they don't cycle. So it's, not yet there. And it's got to advance, and those materials have to stabilize. But we can still demonstrate the potential and therefore see a path.
And how about just getting rid of, say, cobalt and nickel? Because they're kind of a limiting factor in terms of raw materials. Anything in the works that way?
So, yes. And these are the next generation materials that will enable these super high energy densities, and they're based on metal fluorides. And that's what I'm talking about, that don't yet have the stability, but have the potential as the material science advances around these metal fluorides. And the beauty of these metal fluorides is that they're plentiful. There's iron, copper, et cetera. So these are not hard to find. They're abundant in the Earth's crust, and they'll bring down the cost, but significantly advance the performance.
All right. Well, John, thanks for filling in all that information for me. You only get so much from the press releases online. That really answered all of our technical questions. We really appreciate you coming on.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for having me.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics and you listening at home to tell me which one is the fake. Three news items this week, but there's a theme to the news items. And that theme is plastic. Plastic.
Okay.
Just happened to find three items that all had that same theme, so I went with it. All right, here we go. Item number one. Researchers have developed a new sprayable enzyme that can rapidly break down PET plastics at ambient temperatures, making them usable in natural environments, including seawater. Item number two, a new analysis finds that most of the plastic ingested by vultures come directly from food producers like restaurants, rather than landfills or other sources. And item number three, scientists report the development of a new class of material that is rigid, stronger than hard plastics, moldable at low temperature, are endlessly recyclable, made from non-toxic plant material, are stable when coated, but break down in minutes when broken and exposed to water.
Wait, what?
That's a lot.
All right, Kara, you seem anxious to go first.
I knew that was going to happen. Anxious. I also haven't gone first in a while. Sprayable enzyme that breaks down PET... ambient temperatures. I mean, I would hope so. If it only worked when it was like really, really hot or really cold, that wouldn't be very helpful. I think we can already just melt them. But yeah, this is great. I don't know if we want to...
You want to define PET plastics?
So it's polyethylene terephthalate.
Apthalate. What a fun word. Terephthalate.
Terephthalate.
You got to love a PHT situation. Terephthalate. Like phenolphthalein. Phenolphthalein. Anyway, okay. I hope that one's science. I'm going to say it's science. Most of the plastic ingested by vultures comes directly from food producers like restaurants rather than landfills or other sources. What do you mean from food producers like restaurants rather than landfills?
So they're getting it at the restaurant, not at the landfill.
Oh, I mean, I would definitely buy it if it was that it's food waste, but food waste ends up in landfills. That's confusing. But yeah, I mean, vultures like to eat things that are decaying. Carcasses, there's a word for it.
Carrion?
Carrion, thank you. And so that wouldn't surprise me. And is this worldwide or just in America?
I mean, where they studied it, you know. I don't
okay,
think
yeah, you're not going to tell everywhere. Me. Okay, but yeah, I bet you, I think this would be true if it was like in America. I don't think this would be true globally.
So it's okay, so the study was in the southeastern United States.
Okay, yeah, that definitely, I could see
like
that
Florida.
Would be true. Yay, Florida. development of a new class of material that's rigid, stronger than hard plastic. So it's not plastic, but maybe they're calling it like a next-gen plastic. Stronger than hard plastics, moldable at low temperature. Well, that's not smart. Okay. Endlessly recyclable, made from non-toxic plant material. Stable. Okay, no. I don't buy this at all. This everything about this, it's like all the things that we need have the opposite problem, right? So... is something that's really made from non-toxic plant material, it usually degrades much faster. Something that can break down in minutes when exposed to water is not going to be strong. I mean, it might be strong for a second, but it's not useful. So, yeah, I think this one has too many caveats, so I'm going to say this one's the fiction.
Okay, Evan.
All right, Bob, help me with this.
Let's forget the rules.
Bob, you're the material science guy. Yeah, I'm in similar... thinking of what Kara has expressed already. About the first one, so a sprayable enzyme, that sounds pretty cool, rapidly breaking down these kinds of plastics at ambient temperatures, good, making them usable in natural environments, including seawater. Yeah, I don't know a lot about plastic technology, to my detriment, but it does sound reasonable. I wonder if Steve's trying to get us on this one. Number two, the one about the vultures coming directly from food producers like restaurants and DoorDash, rather than landfills and other sources. What's the thing where they put the bodies out for the vultures to? It's like an arena, and they would lay the bodies out. The vultures would come and eat the bodies.
Sky burial.
Is that what it's called? Sky burial?
Sometimes. It depends on where you are. But
yeah. I don't know why I brought that forest up, but just burial, vultures. Yeah. You know, it has nothing to do with this. the image came into my head. But the last one, yeah, the last one's like, oh, wow. It's like the brass ring, the holy grail of everything you wanted in solving the world of plastics, right? Development of a new class of material. I mean, is the development of a class of material the same as the material itself?
Yeah. In other words, to me, yeah, but it's not necessarily one very specific thing, because it could be multiple versions of it. So it's a class of material, right?
I mean, it's the part here, endlessly recyclable. That alone is incredible. Would be wonderful. It's not too good to be true. So is this the one you're trying to give me the getcha on, or should I go with Kara and say no way? And I'll go with Kara and say, yeah, for as much as I think this might try to be a getcha one, too good to be true. I agree with Kara. This one, the new class of material, fiction.
Okay, and Bob?
It's weird because I think the number one seems too good. I mean, you've got a sprayable enzyme that will break down all the major types of plastics that we've all been railing about for years now. I mean, that sounds pretty damn awesome to me.
Yeah, it does. What's the catch?
Yeah. So, and I think the one with all those caveats, that last one was meant for us to have a knee jerk what?
Yeah.
And the restaurant or landfill one just kind of makes sense. So I'm going to depart from the group and go that the enzyme, sprayable enzyme, is fiction.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, so you all agree on this?
I'm like, can Evan and I switch our hands?
Yeah. No. So we'll start with the second one. A new analysis finds that most of the plastic ingested by vultures come directly from food producers like restaurants rather than landfills or other sources. You all think this one is science, and this one is science. This one is science.
Okay.
And a little surprising, the result, you know, was a little, because the assumption was that it was mainly from landfills, but they did, so they did two parts to this study. They looked at the pellets, you know, the poop of vultures, where they roost, and they examine just what's in them. And there's a lot of plastic in there, a lot of other material,
dirt, oh my God,
rock,
man,
glass, but also a lot of, you know, food waste as well. So, you know, so they are eating a lot of plastics. So with an average plastic composition by weight of 8.76%, that was in their pellets. Now, there's an interesting question in there: are the vultures eating it deliberately, because they may eat inedible things in order to help
digest,
basically,
it.
Like fiber, to get some of the crap they eat out of their system, you know, get bone fragments and whatever undigestible stuff, you know, from their food out, or do they think it's food? You know, do they not realize that it's some inedible technological stuff?
Or is it also just like connected to the food?
Right.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's just like something wrapped in plastic.
The other study they did was they tried to correlate the amount of plastic in the feces of vultures with the density of different things in the environment, urban development, restaurants, whatnot. And it correlates really well with the density of restaurants. So it does seem like they are getting their food directly from, probably from like garbage bins outside of restaurants. So the idea is that you could really significantly decrease the amount of plastic that vultures are eating by just making sure you close up your trash bags really well, and you close your trash bins. You don't leave them open for the vultures to get in there and eat the food, because they're eating a lot of plastic.
And also reduce plastic in your food service.
Right. You could also do that.
Yeah. Single-use plastics.
Yep. Bad. So that one was science. So which one or three is too good to be true? Is it?
It's one. We already know it. We can tell. Yes. Bob wins.
I don't know. Really?
All right. Well, if you guys want me to read one first, I'll go there. Researchers have developed a new sprayable enzyme that can rapidly break down PET plastics at ambient temperatures, making them usable in natural environments, including seawater. Bob, you think this one is the fiction? Kara and Evan are absolutely convinced that this one is science. And oh, this one
certified
is... This is the fiction, Bob.
Yeah, go Bob. So, it's not ambient temperatures, is it?
No.
It's not a sprayable enzyme.
No. It has to be hot. I bet you it has to be hot.
Yeah, and not seawater either.
That seawater thing I thought was ludicrous, but I was like, whatever.
Yeah,
I don't want to spray all this stuff into seawater.
The part that was like, okay, so what? You would spray this stuff?
Homeopathic enzyme.
Yeah, you'd solve the whole ocean.
I mean, yeah, this is a little bit too good to be true. So there was a study showing that they did make an incremental advance in one of the PET enzymes, that it's a little bit more efficient than the older one. It's one of these incremental studies. I just use that as sort of a jumping off point to make this like Uber enzyme. But so there's basically two types of enzymes that break down plastics. There are ones that are basically secreted by bacteria, and they do work at ambient temperatures, but they're in bacteria. They're not sprayable. You know, the bacteria are the ones that are eating the plastic. The ones that are just like, you know, you make in a vat or whatever, they mostly operate between 40 and 70 or even more. That's 40 to 70 Celsius, just to clarify, temperature. They need heat there. So these would be used as part of a recycling process, not out there in the natural environment. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't find any that you would like put in seawater. I just threw that in there to make sure it was clearly fiction. Mm-hmm. Okay. Let's go to number 3. Scientists report the development of a new class of material that is rigid, stronger than hard plastics, moldable at low temperatures, are endlessly recyclable, made from non-toxic plant material, are stable when coated, but break down in minutes when broken and exposed to water. That is science. And I don't think there's no catch. I don't think there's any gotcha in there. It's just a really good option. So we'll see.
How does it not fall apart while you're using it?
Because it's coated. That's coated. The thing. You've got to put a coating on there. First of all, it will last as long as you keep it dry, but if any water will break it down. But if you put a coating on it, that keeps it from breaking down. But if there's but once you throw it away, it gets cracks or whatever. Then it'll get exposed to water. Even if you just get cracks in the coating, it'll rapidly degrade.
That sounds pretty good.
But then what's the coating made out of?
Plutonium.
Plastic.
Plutonium.
No. Let's see. What did they use? It was some bio-based material.
Cool.
It wasn't...
Like wax or something.
Yeah. So these are amorphous isomalt materials. They're made out of sugar, basically plant-derived sugars.
Yeah.
And the study was, they figured that if they add certain binders in there, which could be like sawdust or something, then it makes this really hard material that they could mold. They don't have to heat it up. They could mold it at room temperatures. Like it could work for injection molding, which is great because that's what we make all our plastic stuff out of. And it will last for days, last for a long time, especially depending on how well you coat it. And then, but as soon as you throw it away and it breaks up a little bit, then it will break down very, very quickly. So this is intended for short use plastics, like single use plastics.
Which is great because that's what we need to replace.
That's exactly what we need to replace. Exactly. So I read the primary literature on it and the press release. It sounds like it's ticking all the boxes, Also they said there's a closed loop recyclable cycle that seems to be infinitely recyclable. Like it doesn't, unlike regular plastics where they recycle it like once or twice or whatever. But
if they even can, half the time they're not.
Yeah, you can't make it into the same thing that it started out with. But this, you just sort of break it down and just remake it. Could put it through the process again, so it's closed loop recyclable. Yeah, it looks really great. So I don't know what would the feedstock be and how much would it cost or whatever, but
how scalable is it?
Yeah, all those questions you got to ask, but in principle it sounds really good. So I don't know.
Doesn't address the current problem.
We'll see where it goes. Yeah.
Right.
It can be molded like plastics. I mean, it's got it sounds good on paper. But we know how it goes. You always got to see, will this really go into production? But if something like this, or if maybe it needs to be tweaked or whatever, really can come into mass production, imagine if, all of our single-use plastics would just melt away and, that They were made out of sugar, you know, basically.
Imagine if we had done that 30
years ago.
To making plastic. Yeah, because we probably had all these same materials. Well, maybe not, but.
Amorphous isomalt material. So they say, you know, they it says on the paper that it's ready for industrial scale production.
But, all right, let's see it.
Yeah.
We'll see it in action.
Wouldn't that be wonderful, though? You know, like if. Imagine if we're just going to replace all of this single-use plastic with something with basically sugar that's biodegradable.
Yeah, that'd be amazing.
Yeah.
I wonder if you can use it as a coffee cup and then you put sugar in the coffee because it's in...
Well, because it's not just sugar. They're adding like sawdust or something. They got to add some binder in there.
Yeah. Oh, remember in Willy Wonka, he's drinking his tea and then he eats the cup.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That would be the next step.
Yeah.
Use something edible as a binder.
We got to watch that old classic.
It's great. It holds up. It is a classic. And the remake with what's his name?
Johnny Depp. Oh my gosh.
Oh man, just didn't do
Tim
it.
Tim Burton, yeah, I know.
I don't even think I saw it.
I didn't love his take on the character.
No, it didn't work either. And Gene Wilder was just so brilliant. In that role, as Willy Wonka.
It's a seminal role.
I mean,
no doubt about it.
Just amazing. When you nail something like this, why remake it? You know what I mean?
You lose. Good day, sir.
Good day, sir.
We say that often. It's classic.
He was like, I don't know. He hit that sweet spot. He was menacing and mysterious,
yes,
and comical all at the same time. Like, you never knew what the hell was going to happen. It was perfect. He just played that character so well. To the point where he is that character. So you can't reimagine the character. It's like, what? It just didn't work. All right. Anyway, Evan, give us a quote.
All right. This week's quote was suggested by listener Pat in Michigan. Thank you, Pat. And Pat is working through a book called The Scout Mindset by Julia Galef.
Mm-hmm. Ah, Julia.
And yes. And he pointed out this quote from the book. A large portion of overconfidence stems from a desire to feel certain. Certainty is simple. Certainty is comfortable. Certainty makes us feel smart and competent. Your strength as a scout is in your ability to resist that temptation. And in order to understand what she means by scout, I had to go read a little bit about it. So Julia says this. So she says, when it comes to what we believe, humans see what they want to see. In other words, we have what's known as being a soldier mindset, from tribalism and wishful thinking to rationalizing our personal lives and everything in between, we're driven to defend the ideas we want to believe. But if we want to get things right more often, Julia says we should train ourselves to have a scout mindset, which is different than the soldier.
Mm-hmm. We interviewed her about her book.
Yeah.
On a
Tuna
show. Yeah.
Yep.
Where we went over all this. Yeah, very good interview. All right. Well, thank you all for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.